Hi, welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery, leadership revolution, and life success. Learn something new from our mentoring conversation today. We Mentor Inc., along with donations and sponsors from leaders like you, fund this podcast. We Mentor Inc. is an innovative mentoring community I founded in 1992, where small business owners co-create a leadership foundation of mutual human advancement and profitability to reach a level of leadership expertise they've never experienced before. My vision is to revolutionize entrepreneurial leadership and business ownership from the inside out and upside down. There isn't a topic we don't discuss. We focus on bringing out more of who you are and facilitate where you envision yourself to be next as you sustain profitability and growth. You will learn strategies, techniques, and skills to strengthen your leadership and become a more effective innovator. This way, you can capitalize on and participate more fully in our evolving world. You will reinvent yourself as you redesign your business. In the end, you will end up loving your life and loving how you lead and innovate in all its messiness. Here's a few questions. If you're thinking about joining a We Mentor Entrepreneurial Leadership Lab, which is a 24-session, one-year program, do you need new skills and strategies to grow your business? Do you want to participate more fully in this economy? Are you snuffing out creativity and opportunities for innovation because of how you're leading? Is your business running you? Are you tired of your business? Is there a disconnect between you and those you employ? Are you recovering from a major setback and need more skills to recover and rise from the experience with greater clarity, resilience, and a new perspective? Do you want to increase your business acumen and bump up your emotional intelligence while you generate more income? Are you ready to have fun and make more money with how you're leading and mentoring others? Well, you can get started by going to wementor.com. And you can also call me, 612-804-8920. My company, We Mentor Inc., is sponsoring an upcoming event on April 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. There's going to be prizes and raffles, and it's for a purposeful networking event. Professional Sales Association has a purposeful networking event. The fundings that they generate are going to support the work that they're recovery work that they're doing in Haiti. The event is on April 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. The theme is Caribbean. It's at the DoubleTree Park Place Hotel. I'll put a link at the bottom of the show notes. It's $30 per person. Get out there and network with others and put your funds toward a great event. All right, now we're moving into the really good stuff. I'm so excited. Today in the studio is Joe Schmidt. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good, Nancy. Good to be here.
Yeah, good. Well, Joe Schmidt, as you probably know, is an award-winning broadcaster, community leader, and popular keynote speaker. He has covered every major sporting event in the past three decades. He has won 15 Emmys from the National Television Academy and a National Headliner Award. Joe is also a regular on 1500 ESPN Radio. Before joining KSTP-TV in Minneapolis-St. Paul in 1985, he was sports director for WBAY TV in Green Bay, Wisconsin. His career also includes positions for KCRG-TV in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and WKBT-TV in La Crosse, Wisconsin. He is a past president and board member of the Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Greater Twin Cities and a past president and board member of the Fairway Foundation. Joe is also a member of the Pacer Advisory Board and the Minnesota Vikings Advisory Board. He and his wife, Laura, are currently chairing a $7 million capital campaign for Veep, the largest food shelf in Minnesota. You and I met, Joe, at the Roseville Optimist Club in Roseville, Minnesota, when I approached you to autograph your book, Silent Impact: Stories of Influence Through Purpose, Persistence, and Passion.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. I had a nice time with The Optimist.
Right. Yeah, it's a great group.
It is.
Yeah, Don Felsalverda is like the best salesperson and relationship builder that I've ever met.
He would not let me say, no, they're coming to see you.
Did you know everybody in the room, he like called and consistently called them until they joined?
I can imagine. That's what it takes to be a good salesperson, persistence, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was so moved by your book. I just thought, I guess I agree with Harvey McKay's, endorsement for the book. He's the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Swim with the Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive. And he says of Joe's book, silent impact doesn't whisper. It screams with terrific stories and practical advice on how to influence and improve your world.
Yeah, that's very nice. And Harvey's been a friend and a mentor to me over the years. And when I started speaking and writing, Harvey was my first stop.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Certainly was.
Wow.
Well, he's a Hall of Famer. You know, I mean, the one thing I've learned in the TV business and other things that I've done is when you surround yourself with smart people and you ask the right questions, they're always willing to give you great information. So
yeah.
The key is when you do it, then make sure you pay it back when somebody in turn asks you. So that's kind of the key to keep that ball rolling.
Yeah. Yeah, That's your message in the silent impact, too.
It is.
The little things. Well, could I read your introduction?
Sure.
Okay. So you introduced the book by saying, we make our biggest impressions when we are not trying to be impressive. The words we say or don't say, the things we do or don't do, and the way we react or don't react all work together to make a powerful impact on those around us. It's in our daily interactions that we make either a positive or negative impact. He calls this silent impact. What made you decide to write the book?
Well, I left broadcasting for a few years, and one of the things I did was I ended up doing a lot of speaking because people wanted to know why would you change, and I was working in a business and a nonprofit, and all of a sudden I realized I better have some content when I speak. So instead of doing the it all started at a 10,000-watt radio station speech, I started telling stories about people I met, and all of a sudden I realized all these great stories that people liked had a theme. They were all about people who had an impact.
Yeah.
Well, a long story short, I decided to take my business to a professional level. I hired coaches and I talked to people like Harvey McKay, Walter Bond, some people I know who are big-time professional speakers, Dave Horsager, Ross Bernstein. There's a bunch of people in Minnesota who do this professionally. They write, yeah. They're thought leaders. And I decided to put together a business. And when I put together a business, one of the teams I hired down in Texas worked me through my content, and that's where we stumbled on Silent Impact. The first name of my speech was The Pursuit of Happiness, and all of a sudden I realized that, well, that's kind of what everybody does, and that's a little bit soft. It's not really a corporate kind of sell, and as we talked and talked, she said, all your stories have the same theme. And she said, everybody is kind of, you know, making an impact, having an influence. I said, yeah, it's kind of like a silent impact. And she said, what did you say? I said, it's like a silent impact. She goes, boom, there's the name of your book. There's the name of your speech. There's what you're doing moving forward. And that's really how it happened.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It came out of a, you know, kind of a thought session where we were throwing a bunch of stuff up against the wall and see what stuck. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
And since then, it's taken on a whole new life of its own, too.
Oh, so tell us the path that it's kind of led you in.
Well, I first kind of got into it thinking I would speak. And, the next thing I know, I'm speaking. I'm doing half-day seminars. I've got year-long programs with, you know, major clients like United Health to small banks to, you know, just everybody wanted more. So I'd speak,
nice.
And everybody
yeah.
wanted more. So I had to do more. I had to do more research. I had to add more to the arsenal. So,
yeah.
You know, I've got a menu now. When somebody comes to me, I can say, what are you hoping to accomplish? And I say, well, let's throw out some ideas. And I can say, why don't we do this, this, and this? And it's worked out really well because I think what happened is when I started speaking, I realized that I can speak to a room like the Optimist Club, and everybody's going to walk out of there and feel good about it. Everybody's going to walk and say, I'm going to change the way I impact others. I'm going to be more aware. I'm going to be more intentional with the impact I have on everybody else. But you get back to your office and you have 30 emails to respond to, two people hanging out your office, and five phone calls to make before 5 o'clock. Guess what? That whole speech just went out the window. So what I knew I had to develop was, how do we keep the momentum going? So that's when I started developing these workshops that I do, that we can go up to a day on, and then we develop a year-long program, a year-long plan for impact for a company.
Okay.
And then I do videos for them every month based on the research and based on what the employees of that company came up with. So then you have buy-in.
Yeah,
because too many times what happens is corporate America, some committee in corporate America comes up and says, these are our six core values.
Right.
Well, you know what the worker bees think about those six core values? They could care less.
Yeah.
But what happens if you got everybody involved in the process where they pick out what they're going to focus on? They know the issues of that company. They know what can improve the culture of the company.
Yeah.
And when you improve the culture of the company, you make some connections, you're going to have a higher, productive, happier team. I mean, it's that simple.
Yeah.
It's that simple, and we all know it, but sometimes I think corporate America kind of ignores it because they get caught up in profit and loss statements and numbers and, try to, if they're big, they're worried about stockholders. If they're small, they're worried about survival.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to live by some of those values if they're not clear on, and they're not integrated into the workplace. So getting the emotional buy-in.
Yeah.
Where people feel it's more real.
I use this line, and I don't even should call it a line, but when I'm talking to people, I say, if you have employees that feel that they're overworked and underappreciated, this is for you. And they all go, well, that's us. Well, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of companies. Right now, the latest polls, there was a new one that came out by Gallup, and I think 72% of the people in business right now are unengaged.
Yeah.
They don't even care about their company. They basically care about working their 40 hours, getting their paycheck every 2 weeks, and don't care about the company.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big problem.
Yeah.
So how do you get your employees engaged? How do you get them to care about the project? Well, it's got to start from up top. You have to care about the people. You have to make connections with the people. You have to figure out what makes them tick and make them part of the process. And that's where ultimately when I turned silent impact, I turned it into impact leadership.
Yeah.
Because it's not leadership from the mountain. It's, it's leadership by connecting and caring. What's your purpose? Are you being persistent? And where's your passion? So that's kind of how the book is broken down into those three areas.
Yeah, and you've got fantastic stories that really I savor them. I've been savoring them.
The power of the story, and that's why I'm a storyteller first. And there's no question that, it's why parables work in the Bible.
Yeah.
They're stories.
Yeah.
With a moral at the end of it. And people remember the stories. And when I speak, and you heard me speak, and it wasn't probably my full speech, but I tell a bunch of different stories. And what always happens afterwards is somebody comes up to me, and I'm always amazed. And, they'll say, I'm thinking they're going to talk about the Joe Mauer story, or they're going to talk about one of my they picked out one little, that bar you were talking about? We used to have a bar like that in our hometown, and we used to go to that bar, and we had a guy like that, so everybody can relate at some level when you tell a story.
Yeah, and the bar you're talking about is the bar that your dad
founded. Yeah, I grew up in a bar.
That
my dad ran, and it was in a small town, and the farmers came in early to after they milked their cows did their chores. Their happy hour was at 10 in the morning, and
right.
My dad had the bar open because they would want their shot of whiskey and a beer and find out what was happening from my dad. So that's kind of how that story goes. And I kind of, after a while, the more you speak, you kind of think a little deeper and you get these responses back. And I figured out, have you ever gone to a movie after you've read the book? So what's your first response? I like the book better.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
And you know why you like the book better? because in your mind, you have already established the scene. You know what the characters look like. You know what that bar looks like. You know what that barn looks like. You know what that storm looked like blowing in from the west.
Yeah.
So you have that in your mind. So when you go to the movie, the director or the producer of the film had something else in mind. So that's how come the book was always better. So when I tell these stories, I realize that the bar I'm describing, or when I describe Joe Mauer and his lunchroom at Crete and Durham Hall,
yeah.
Unless you went to Crete, you don't know what that lunchroom looked like. But I guarantee you, everybody thinks about their high school lunchroom, and they might even think about where they sat and who they sat with.
Yeah, right.
So people put themselves into the story. And when you put yourself into the story, that's where I think it does resonate. It can make that impact.
Right, because I can visualize. I grew up in a dairy farm, and so I can visualize you know, the farmers coming in and, you know, from a real life experience and catching up on the news of the day.
Sure. And the gossip and tell a couple of jokes and, you know, and I would just see it happen every day and every day. And, you know, I always think that, you know, they probably had one more beer than they had planned on having before they go back and take their nap. Shouldn't be saying that, but that's probably the case. A different time and era.
Right. Still hardworking. So you also had some chores to do before school.
Oh, yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
Farm kids were out there milking cows, and you were preparing the bar, right,
oh, yeah.
for the day.
Every morning we, you know, I like to do the bottle shoot. You know, back in those days, if you had a bottle of beer, there'd be a chute that they would put the bottle down. It would go downstairs, and they'd have a rubber thing that would kind of slow it down, and you'd have to put the Miller bottles in the Miller and the Pabst in the Pabst and in the
for
boxes.
For recycling?
For recycling back
okay.
then.
Okay, all right.
It wasn't called recycling back then. It was bottles cost too much. Somebody okay. had the dirtiest job was emptying the ashtrays and cleaning the ashtrays. That was the one nobody wanted because that was disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
Even
right.
back then it was. And we swept and we just, you know, it was like a family farm. It was a family business. You know, Fridays was fish fry. And, you know, we knew that we had to be patient with mom on Fridays because mom would be, besides raising six kids, would be getting ready for the Friday onslaught of people coming in for perch and french fries.
Yeah, right.
And
right,
it was just, yeah, it was just.
So she did all the cooking?
She did all the cooking, yeah.
Wow.
And my dad worked hard, you know, behind the bar and there were some advantages. My dad used to have penny candy behind the bar that he would give the kids because back in those days, people would bring their kids to the bar. You know,
yeah.
that's just kind of the way it was in a small town.
Yeah.
And dad would hand them penny candy. Well, before I went to school every morning, my brothers and I, we'd load up our pockets full of penny candy trying to be the most popular kids at school. So
there you go.
We're no dummies.
Yeah, exactly. So you started your business.
Yeah. I wasn't selling it. I wasn't that entrepreneurial at that time.
Okay. You were just passing them out to make friends.
Exactly.
Well, later they would buy from you because you formed the friendship first.
Friendship equity. The best. That's the best thing in the world.
Yeah. Oh, that's excellent. What else? So that was a family business then you grew up in. How did it turn out in the process? Are your parents still alive?
No, I lost both my parents. One of the stories I do tell in the book, and I do tell a lot of keynotes, is my father passing away. And the story I tell is how before he passed away, his best friend died, and how all of a sudden my dad was, you know, inviting this young boy to all of our family events.
Oh, right,
and then
yes.
The impact it had on me is I became a big brother in the Big Brothers program without even knowing why I did.
Yeah.
And ultimately, after I tell the long story, all of a sudden, I realize 20 years later, now I knew why I became a big brother, because my dad had been a big brother to his best friend who he died, his best friend died, and my dad took his son under his wing and made sure that his son had a male figure in his life.
And the extended brother that was brought into the home was also not, it took a while for you to kind of come to terms with that because you already came from a big family.
Yeah, we had six kids and Donnie made seven. The story goes that I had, as I went on to school and started my broadcasting career, I had lost track of Donnie. The next time I saw Donnie, I was 25 years old and Donnie was crying. It was at my dad's funeral.
Yeah.
And then that's when I started to realize that my dad had this amazing impact on Donnie. I had no idea. And about a year before my father passed away, I had become a big brother in the Big Brothers program, not sure why I did. Uh-huh. Well, I still didn't understand it until years later when I started a charity golf tournament for Big Brothers because I loved the organization so much. The executive director of Big Brothers, you know, was asking me about my dad. And that's when I realized, oh my gosh, my dad was a big brother to Donnie. He didn't have a group or organization around him,
yeah.
but he had an amazing silent impact on me. I had become involved in this organization, and I was able to pay it forward because of the lessons that my dad taught me that were real and powerful and profound and contagious, and they can last a long, long time. That's how this silent impact works.
Yeah.
And it's both a personal leadership, it's a professional leadership, it's a way to try to lead your life, and we all get busy, we all make mistakes, we all do things we wish we had back. But I think if we all try to be more aware and more intentional with the impact that we have on each other, it's going to be a lot smoother.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the reason for your success, too, with working with companies and in the speaking industry outside of sports, is because of your life mission.
Well, it kind of became my mission.
Yeah.
But I think it was two worlds collided pretty well. You know, as a broadcaster and as a journalist, I have a natural sense of curiosity, and I'm always asking questions.
Yeah.
So whenever I find a story, like, for example, the Donnie story,
yeah.
you know, I use my reporting skills. I went and I found Donnie, and 25 years later, I talked to Donnie about the impact that my dad had on him. And I found out stories that my dad, I never knew my dad, went back and you know, helped discipline the kid when he was stepped out of line as much as his, you know, best friend could
would have done.
Yeah. And just to step in there to be that male figure. And I remember when my mom died, it was after the book came out. I hadn't seen those people in years. And the entire family came to my mom's funeral, which was pretty cool because it was, and they were all there and they all talked about the book and they all talked about the impact. And it was just an honor for them that, you know, their father, you know, was still remembered after all those years. So it's just, you know, it just, some amazing things happen. I have a couple of stories in a book about Bart Starr, because when I worked in Green Bay, I covered Bart Starr.
Yeah.
And one of the stories I tell is on a snowy night, back in those days, I was covering the Green Bay Packers. All right. I know you're from Minnesota. I'm not a Packer fan. I covered the Green Bay Packers. Just let me say that. It was my job. I grew up in that area. Yes, I did like them growing up. But anyway, after a Monday night football game, a snowy night came back to Green Bay, and there was a kid on the side of the road trying to change a tire. I mean, it was like 20 below zero in the middle of a snowstorm.
Yeah.
And everybody on the plane, including all the players, coaches, media, we all drove past the guy and let him out there suffer in the snow. Well, one guy stopped. It was Bart Starr. Well, I found out about it later because the guy who was stuck in the snow I went to high school with, the guy was trying to change his tire. So talk about double guilt. Well, now, fast forward, and this is how this works. So fast forward, I had a speech at Lambeau Field. And the old ticket director is an old friend of mine from way back when. So I went and saw him afterwards, and we talked. And I said, how's Bart doing? He said, he's doing great. And I said, give me his address. I said, I'm going to send him a book. I got a couple of stories about Bart in the book. Well, I no longer put the book in the mail. And I heard that Bart had a stroke. He had suffered a heart attack. He had some very serious health issues. I felt kind of sheepish for putting the book in the mail when people are sending flowers and cards. I'm sending him a book. You know, it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Well, about 3 weeks later, I got a letter from Cherry Starr, Bart's wife, and she just sent the nicest letter saying, I'm not sure if you heard about Bart. He's had some health issues, she said, and he's really been struggling, but I want to let you know, I read the stories that I had, that you had about Bart in the book, and you should have seen him light up. And I thought to myself, here's a guy who had a huge impact on me because of the way he lived his life, and he was true. He was the kind of guy that walked the walk and talked the talk. And without even trying, I was able to pick him up in a moment.
Oh.
You know, without, I'm not trying to be a hero in this thing. I just did it. So that's how it happens.
Right.
Kind of just do the right thing. Think of other people once in a while instead of yourself first. And the next thing you know, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It was a nice full circle.
Right. I love those full circle moments. And we don't have a lot of them.
No. But you know what? If you try, you can. you know? I think that's part of it. I think too many people sit on their haunches and don't make the call or don't send the text or don't check in.
Yeah.
Don't let somebody know they care and all those kinds of things. And we all need to get better at it.
Yeah. My brother passed away when he was 37 from lymphoma cancer. You have the same, but his was fast growing.
Mm-hmm.
And a neighbor of ours, about a year later, sent a letter to my parents and said what an influence my brother was in his life growing up.
Wow.
And we had moved from that area. I mean, it was like, you know, 7-8 years since we had, gone back there. So it does make a huge impact when you do something and acknowledge an influence in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just did a presentation for a company, and it was a half-day seminar. And one of the things I do in the half-day seminar is I use the metaphor, your Mount Rushmore of influence. So, because I started thinking, how can we all be more aware and more intentional? Because I think that's what these people, I call them impact players, people who have this magic silent impact, they do it more often than others.
Yeah.
And I think they're more aware and more intentional. So I came up with a metaphor, if we could all develop our own Mount Rushmore of influence to put the four most impactful people in our life on our own monument, who would be there and why would they be there? So I literally get a picture of Mount Rushmore and I make people fill it out at a conference. And I tell them they can't put their parents in because that's too easy.
Yeah.
And I want them to dig a little deep because I want them to think about, go back to a teacher, a coach, a boss, a tough boss, maybe someone who was negative in your life but had a positive impact, have them think a little bit.
Yeah.
So then they put them down and then they share those stories because you want to create a culture in a company. You want to get to know more about people you're working with.
Yeah.
Talk at that level.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you might understand this person who's been a big troublemaker in your office. All of a sudden you might understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Makes it a little bit easier. So I did this, and afterwards a gentleman shared with me that he had put his brother on there, and he said he would not have put his brother on his Mount Rushmore of influence a year earlier. And he went on to tell the story about how his brother died of ALS. He was a guy who ran an elevator for the Columbus Blue Jackets, the hockey team in Columbus,
Ohio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And thank you. Didn't say it was good at geography. So Columbus, Ohio. And anyways, he was just part-time job, ran an elevator. And when he died, the entire team showed up. All the media showed up. This guy had this impact on so many. So this brother who lost his brother at ALS was hearing these stories of impact that his brother had. And he had no idea. Uh-huh. And he just said, and he came back. So here's the full circle to that story.
Okay.
So I think that's kind of cool. So
this
brother all of a sudden realizes, here's a guy I lived with. We fought like cats and dogs growing up. And we stayed in contact all these years, but I never really knew who he was or what he did.
Yeah.
So at the end of my speech, I tell a story about Roy Griak, the longtime track coach at the University of Minnesota, who when he was dying, all the tributes to him had nothing to do about his great track coaching career, nothing to do about thank you for making me an Olympian, thank you for making me a Big Ten champ. They were all about thank you for making me a better man. Mm-hmm. I'm a better spouse now because of you. Things, I just closed the biggest business deal in my life using Roy Griak 101. So I kind of used it at the end saying, when it's all said and done, what really matters is, did you have an impact? Were you significant?
Yeah.
So, and it's a pretty poignant way to kind of, as I'm wrapping it up, to wrap it up afterwards. So afterwards, the guy who told me about the ALS thing told the story in front of the whole conference. So everybody got to know him a little bit better.
Sure.
And he came up to me and goes, you're not going to believe this. My brother ran track for Roy Griak for 2 years. Isn't that wild?
That is crazy.
Talking about the full circle. This guy's talking about impact. And all of a sudden, I then come back 20 minutes later, tell this story on this guy who's had this amazing silent impact on so many people. And we found out there was one more.
Oh.
Just because of his brother.
You know what I mean? Right. Now I get it. Yeah.
Craziness, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's really, you're getting the point across very clearly. I'll put in the mentoring tips, the exercise with Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, that definitely is one. I know you asked me for some tips. And the Mount Rushmore is one I would do, and I'll take it a step further.
Oh, good.
So I did a, I do this presentation for everything from high school to, you know, I did two things for 3M this summer. You know, so I mean, I'm doing Thrivent. I'm doing all these big companies, but I also do small companies and I do high schools. Obviously, I changed the topic a little bit as I do. Well, I had been hired by this leadership group, leaders from all over the northern part of the state, high school kids, had gathered for the day. And I worked with them during the day. And in the late afternoon, their parents came and I worked with the parents in the late afternoon. Then I brought them all together. Well, I made the kids do their Mount Rushmore of influence. Then I made the parents do their Mount Rushmore of influence. Uh-huh. And when I got them all together, I made them compare their Mount Rushmores. Why had parents come up to me? Thank you. That's amazing. I never knew this about my kid. I had kids come up to me. I never knew this about my dad. Whatever. I started thinking, I said, this is a great exercise for families to do.
Yeah. You know, it makes them, your parents, more human and your kids more, you know, in tune with them.
Did you ever tell your kids, about some teacher who had an impact on you? Did you ever, have your kids ever, you know, they might have talked about some teacher, but did you know why they had that impact? And all of a sudden these stories come out and it was groundbreaking. Yeah. It really was. I mean,
oh, absolutely. I can imagine that.
Yeah. And yeah. It's sitting around the dinner table, you don't do that. You know, sitting around the dinner table, you go, who's gonna mow the lawn and who's gonna carry out the garbage? And
functional things.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and you might have been hearing in the background that Sylvia Cabea is our sound engineer today. She's filling in for Mike Cabea.
Nice, Sylvia.
Okay. Terrific. Well, that seems like a great spot to kind of finish out our program today. Mm-hmm. We have a lot more to cover.
Yeah, let's do another
let's
one.
Let's do it. Okay. All right. Terrific. All right. Well, thanks so much, Joe.
You bet, Nancy.
Thanks for being
here.
Thanks, Sylvie, for filling in for Mike. She says hi to everybody. And thanks all of you for tuning in and getting some really silent impact tips. I think this is really critical. It's a game changer. So get out there this week and figure out an area that you want to influence other people and intentionally go out and do your Mount Rushmore exercise. And you could even do it with your employees.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I'm working with small business, and they've got enough people that they could really do that kind of exercise with. Mm-hmm. Great. And there's some teachers listening. They can also do it with their classroom or have them do it with their parents. There's lots of different ways that people can carve this out and be creative in how they use the Mount Rushmore exercise to make a bigger influence.
Fantastic.
All right. See everybody next week. Have a great week.